Hey there, and welcome back to Take One, the podcast that brings you just one playful page of Talmud each day. And in today's pages, Bava Metzia 46 and 47, we hear the sound of tokens all around us. Have a listen. The Gemara returns to an analysis of a passage in the Mishnah. When one party takes possession of an asimon, the other party acquires the minted coin. The Gemara asks, what is an asimon? Rav said, it is one of the coins given as a token to gain entry into the bathhouse, for which the bathers would pay later. The rabbis are then off to the races, trying to figure out what value, if any, this asimon, this token, really has. Clearly, they say it's worth something because, hey, it gets you into the bathhouse. But could you use it, for example, as the tithe sent to the temple in Jerusalem? They argue, and finally they agree that an asimon is what they call a pulsa, a metal piece that is empty of any meaning or any form. It's good, true, for one specific thing, but it has no real inherent value. I'll be honest, I found this conversation particularly thrilling. Once upon a time, before I spent my days studying Gemara, I completed a PhD at Columbia University in video games. It's a fact that still makes 7-year-old me very proud, remembering how many hours I spent playing video games as a boy, first with the Atari and then with a Nintendo system. So the rabbi's discussion today brought me back to one of the most profound insights about video games and why they're such a perfect medium for our economic moment in history. Rather than explain this myself, I would like to share with you a short selection from a terrific essay titled Play It Again, Pac-Man, by the poet Charles Bernstein, who understood video games better than most of our contemporary self-appointed experts. Bernstein is talking here about old school arcade games, the kind where you had to put in a quarter or a token, if you will, in Asimon, and play until you ran out of time. Here goes. The arcade games, Bernstein writes, are designed in part to convince players to part and keep parting with their quarters. This part of the action feels like slot machine gambling, with the obvious difference that there is no cash payoff, only more time online. Staying plugged in, more time to play, is the fix. The arcade games are all about buying time and the possibility of extending the nominal, intensely atomized 30-second or so minimum play to a duration that feels, for all impractical purposes, unbounded. Clearly, the dynamic of the ever more popular home games is different enough that the two need to be considered as quite distinct social phenomena, even though they share the same medium. Like sex, good play on an arcade video game not only earns extra plays, but also extends and expands the length of the current play, with the ultimate lure of an unlimited stretch of time in which the end bell never tolls, a freedom from the constraints of time that resembles the temporal plenitude of uninterrupted live TV or closed-circuit video monitoring, as well as the timeless, continuous present of the personal computer. In contrast, a film ticket or video rental buys you just 90 or 120 minutes of media, no extensions, as opposed to reruns, possible. Meanwhile, the home video game, by allowing longer play with greater skills, simulates the temporal economy of the arcade product while drastically blunting the threat of closure, since on the home version, it costs nothing to replay. Video games create an artificial economy of scarcity in a medium characterized by plentitude. In one of the most popular genres, you desperately fight to prolong your staying power, which is threatened by alien objects that you must shoot down. There's no intrinsic reason that the threat of premature closure should drive so many of these games. For example, if your quarter always bought 2 minutes of play, the effect of artificial scarcity would largely disappear. Is this desire to postpone closure a particular male drive, suggesting a peculiarly male fear? It may be that the emphasis on the overt aggression of a number of the games distracts from seeing other dynamics inherent in video game formats. Another dynamic of the arcade games, Bernstein concludes, is the ubiquitous emphasis on scoring. These games are not open-ended. Not only do you try to accumulate the most points in order to extend play and win bonus games, but also to compete with a machine's lifetime memory of best ever scores. If achievement-directed scoring suggests sex as opposed to love, games more than play, then it seems relevant to consider this a central part of the appeal of video games. You only accumulate points in order to extend play. There it is. The logic of the Asimon, the logic of video games, the logic of working 60-hour weeks only to work harder, to work more, to work always. As we launch into this new work week, let's see if maybe, somewhere on this machine, there's a pause button. This has been Take One. If you enjoy the show, and I hope that you do, then you are really going to love the new book just published by me. It's called How the Talmud Can Change Your Life, Surprisingly Modern Advice from a Very Old Book. You can order it now at your local bookstore or directly from the publisher through the link in this here podcast description or through that big online store whose logo is, you know, a smile. As always, please go rate and review Take One on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You could get your Take One t-shirts and mugs and other swag at tabletstudios.com, and you could subscribe to our weekly newsletter at tabletm.ag/Take One Newsletter. Take One is a Tablet Studios production. The show is hosted by me, Leah Leibowitz, and is produced and edited by Josh Cross, Robert Scaramucci, Quinn Waller, and Ellie Blyer. Our team also includes Stephanie Butney, Courtney Hazel, and Tanya Singer. For more information, go to tabletmag.com/takeone or email us at takeone@tabletmag.com. I hope we have made your day a little more Talmudic.